Hi, this is James Devine, and I am an educator who has come out of the trenches. Listen in as my friend and colleague Dana Goodyear shares stories and tips from other educators who have come out of the trenches.
Welcome to the Out of the Trenches podcast. This is Dana Goodyear. Thanks for listening. Susanna Calverley, PhD, has followed a circuitous route to her current role in ed tech innovation. She has worked in nonprofit, corporate, K-12, and higher education. She currently works as an ed tech specialist for preschool through 12th grade independent school and is a member of the I2E Microsoft Global Training Partner Team. She delights in outdoor activity and engaging her body and mind in gratitude to center herself. Welcome to the podcast, Susanna.
Thanks so much, Dana. I'm really glad to be here.
Well, tell me a story about a time when you came out of the trenches and what you learned from that experience.
Yeah. I think there are so many. I live in the Pacific Northwest. I live in the Seattle area. And we have the benefit up here of living very close to a lot of outdoor spaces. And for me, particularly, being outdoors is a revitalizing and rejuvenating experience. So it's almost any time I can go make time in the space outdoors, I feel like I'm getting out of the trenches, even if that's just in an afternoon sortie, right? But I actually have a story that's very recent. Just a couple of weeks ago, my family and I went across the Cascade Mountains into central Washington, where it's very remote, and found a little tiny little remote campsite on Forest Service lands under some trees in the river in a forest where there's, of course, completely off-grid. There's no connectivity, no other people around. And being able to go out gives me space and time to reflect. Mm-hmm. And it gives me, so even though I disconnect digitally, mm-hmm. if you will, I'm still connected in my heart and mentally to what's going on. I mean, there are times when I completely let that go. Mm-hmm. But in this particular time where we're at right now, so it's August right now in 2020, mm-hmm. during the pandemic, and Washington State is still in a very, very phased approach to opening back up. And so we are, as school comes closer and as I'm working with my team, it's a very, very heavy time. And just trying to come up for a few moments to breathe and to look over the horizon, mm-hmm. And be able to see a little bit further and to not feel as down in the muck of the day-to-day and the administrivia and the important things. And there were tons of important things that are going on right now. But being outdoors and being disconnected so that I could fully process and not be constantly pulled in different directions, right? And that meant that when I came back, I had a better handle on what to prioritize, on also just more gracious attitude, mm-hmm. on when things were being asked of me that were randomizing, you know, I need this, I need this, I need this. Having had that time to take a breath makes a difference. And it also gives, for me, being in the outdoors at any point, gives me a much broader view of what's important. And while my work is very important, and every question that a teacher asks of me is incredibly important, seeing the mountains, seeing the wildflowers, being in the wind and the dust and the sun and in the rivers, helps me have a better perspective on the fact that our world is much broader. Yeah. than what we are experiencing this week or this semester even. And that for me gives me energy to keep going.
Yeah, I really like how you word that. I feel the same way. I live in Colorado and, you know, our geography is pretty similar, mm-hmm. With the Rocky Mountains. And, you know, I went 2 weeks ago to Durango in the part of the state, the southwest part of the state we hadn't seen before. So just spending a couple days in a new area of the state, right? And exploring and being away from it all. And, you know, I went to North Carolina early July, and I wouldn't say I totally disconnected because I haven't been on like a camping trip, and, you know, without the Wi-Fi and all that this summer, but at least getting away where you're, you know, realizing that you're not at home, you're not doing the quote unquote mundane tasks of planning for school to start and all that. And, you know, I think for a lot of us to keep our head on our shoulders, right, this summer, we've had to take that time, right, and really take care of ourselves, take care of our families. And I really like how you start out about, you know, your way of coming out of this kind of trench that we're in right now is taking that time. And hopefully, you know, over the fall and into the winter, are you planning on taking more of these type trips to the mountains or the?
Yeah, we'll see. It's difficult because we're still on limited travel recommendations here in our area. And so we have to be very careful about where we're going and that we're not impacting people who are more vulnerable. Because we do still have quite a bit of active virus here in the region. So yes, we'll probably take a couple of smaller camping trips, but they won't likely be as remote just for time purposes. But we find that even just leaving our house, you know, having been isolated here for so many months, even just leaving our house and like taking our trailer or our tent to someone else's property, even if it's not like a real campground, that can give you the feeling of separation so that you can reflect more deeply and move forward with more energy.
No, I really like how, just even leaving, you know, 20 minutes away, driving 20 minutes away and pitching a tent is a good way of kind of having that outdoor lifestyle. So this kind of segues into our next question about how do you balance work and your outdoor lifestyle? You know, disconnecting from work, right? It could be something that you do in the evening or in the weekend, even if a lot of the workload is piling up. How do you kind of turn on that off button?
Yeah, that's a hard one. And some weeks I'm much better at it than others, I'll admit. my family has an incredible privilege of living in a home where we have a yard that is, we've planted a lot of native plants in our yard, and it's a good amount of space. And so I like to go out and get my hands in the dirt and maintain my garden in the front and the back. And being in the native plants means that we have lots of different critters that come through for those native plants. So birds and bees and other things, some not as desirable, but even just seeing them and knowing that we're providing habitat is beneficial. And that's on days when I don't actually get to go out and be in the outdoors, I can see it right around me. We are pretty intentional. My husband and I have started taking walks in the mornings, most mornings, early, between 6 and 7:30, just a short walk to be able to walk the streets and, breathe the air before we have to get going in the day. And that's, again, that's not an outdoor adventure, but it is being in fresh air. Our neighborhood actually has a green belt in it that is not old growth forest, but probably second growth forest for our area. And I'll take myself into that little forest. And it's funny because it's right next to the freeway. So it's like there's the freeway and then there's this strip of land and then there's the neighborhood, right? The city development. But in that strip of land, even though you can hear the freeway, it is forest and it's proper forest. It's not a planted forest, and there's even a stream that runs through it at one point. And I find that when I take myself through there on a walk, it's incredibly revitalizing. The Japanese have this term called forest bathing, and that's how I feel even when I'm there. Even though I can hear the freeway zooming by next to me, maybe kind of close your ears a little bit and you think it's a river, but like being under the trees makes a huge difference. So during the week, that's what I'll tend to do, is try to do that sort of excursion where it's very, very casual and just getting out. I'm not driving anywhere. I'm just walking outside. And then our family does try to hike. So we do try to get out into longer hikes. So 4 to 10 miles hikes on weekends. And that doesn't get to happen every weekend because we do have a home that we're caring for and we do have other things that we're engaged in. But when we have those hikes, I've definitely had my husband look at me and say, "Oh my goodness, like the years fall off of you when you're in the forest. Like you just, you can tell that you're so much more at ease and that you're breathing deeper and that you feel more vital when you're out in the wilderness. And it's definitely true. And so though that's a way that we try to get away. And we will do that every other weekend or a few times a month, maybe. And just for a day hike, a few hours in the morning. And that's something that usually we can fit in and it doesn't feel like it's too much of a strain on our work schedules to be able to do either our morning walks or an evening walk or a hike on a weekend. And then our bigger excursions, like, and those of you watching on YouTube, that's Crater Lake in back of me here. That was from a backpacking trip we took two summers ago. So our bigger excursions like backpacking or camping or road trips, those only happen once or twice a year. But when they do happen, we do try to fully disengage. And so we're trying not to work at all when we're on those types of excursions, or we're remote and we can't connect. That's harder right now with my role that I currently have, because I am responsible for preschool through 12th grade innovation and professional development and getting the school continuing to help the school with remote learning and blended learning scenarios. And so I can't disconnect as much as I would usually on those types of trips. So we've found this summer that when we've gone for our little mini camping trips, like I explained earlier, we'll still be somewhere where I can connect and I can take meetings or I can work on a project. But then we go for a little hike and I can release it again. And it's good that way.
Yeah, no, I really think that, these are wise words that you're giving the listener, just, you know, taking that time to disconnect. And, you know, it could be far away from your house. It could be just in the forest, like you said, alongside the highway, but I've read also about the benefits of that forest bathing, right? And how maybe in the U.S. we don't necessarily make that a part of our lifestyle, but we should, right? Because we have the nature around us. It's just kind of taking the time to enjoy the nature. And so you asked me to talk a little bit about your nonprofit and how has that nonprofit that you started served you in your current role?
Yeah. Well, I didn't start it, but I did. I was a part of starting several nonprofits. So while they were not my organizations, I've been on boards and as a support member for various nonprofits. And some of them have been education oriented, well, like academically education oriented. So there's one that's currently still running in Seattle called University Tutors for Seattle Schools. And it's bringing in college educated folks from all different backgrounds to serve in some of Seattle's highest needs elementary, middle, and high schools. Mm-hmm. And working in that organization helps bring me out of the trenches. So I started doing that work when I was working on my PhD at Seattle Pacific University, because one of my colleagues, Professor Greg Kritzberg, he's the one who first started that organization. And I came with him for a few years, for 3 or 4 years, to help it expand. And the way that that helped me bring me out of the trenches was it gave me that broader focus. So, right, when we're doing our PhDs, we're often very, very much focused on what it is that we're investigating and on our coursework and on our research. And while my research did focus on working with underserved youth, I still was doing research. It wasn't necessarily active, right? So being involved in the nonprofit sector during that time was really beneficial because it gave me that view of, yes, what I'm doing matters. And here's part of why it matters is because we are working with these youth and these are the youth that I'm writing about, that I'm reading about, that I'm researching. And I'm also working with them by providing education model, role models and tutors for them. So that was one side. And then the other types of nonprofit that I've worked with, an organization called Sixth Day Dance, which is an adaptive dance organization here in the Seattle area as well. So we work with some of the city's parks and recs departments to offer adaptive dance programs for adults with physical and mental disabilities. And so we provide dance classes for them and then performance opportunities for them as well, and partner them with professional dancers so that they get that performance experience. And I worked with that organization on their as a board member for about 5 years, maybe 6 years. And again, that was another way to see see the impact of the types of things that I cared about in academia. So accessibility, inclusion, being applied in a real world setting. And it gives you motivation to keep going in academia. And another nonprofit that I've recently involved in, a friend of mine also started, it's called Joshua 1-9 Ministries, and it's in the Dominican Republic. And it's a baseball-centered ministry for youth. Baseball is pretty much the biggest route out of poverty in the DR at this point for young people who are living in the severely impoverished regions of the country. And unfortunately, the Major League Baseball organizations take huge advantage of these children and their families. And it's a pretty horrible situation. And so when my friend, who used to be involved in some of those more like the major league organizations, realized what was going on, she decided to start her own organization to ensure that these students are still attending school, that they're being provided for nutritionally, and that you're not just caring for the one child, but for the entire community. And so Joshua 1-9 serves at a little town called Fondonegro near Barahona in the Dominican Republic. And what they've set up is a feeding program for all the children who are involved, currently actually their families as well during the COVID crisis in the DR. It ensures that the students are still enrolled in school and that they're succeeding in school. It also gives them spiritual community because they have a pastor or several pastors who work alongside the team to help counsel the children as they're engaged. So my son and my husband and I went down a couple summers or a couple winters ago in November, two Novembers ago, to visit and to participate. And again, gives you that moment of saying, oh my goodness, the amount of privilege that I have, not just as an academic, but as an American and as a Pacific Northwesterner for me, and as a white woman, and just seeing that again and saying, this is why I do what I do. This is why I care about education. And this revitalizes me for going back into the trenches and continuing the work that I do. So those are some of the nonprofit experiences that I've had over the recent years before I went into the field of education, or maybe kind of between, no, really before. So I also worked for a denomination, a church denomination in Chicago for the Evangelical Covenant Church at their headquarters. And the benefit of having done that is that I saw how nonprofits worked at the large scale. And then I've been able to apply that work or that understanding to my work at the smaller nonprofits as I've gone along the way.
No, I think that's a great list of just kind of those experiences that you've had. I mean, not everybody has experience working in nonprofits, and, you know, a lot of people have been on mission trips and helped people maybe in, you know, Central America, like you've talked about the Dominican Republic, but the fact that you have such a wide range of nonprofit experience with the University Tutors, the Baseball Center Ministry, And I'll ask you to send me the links to those, and I'll link those up in the show notes as well, so listeners can have access to some of these nonprofits that you mentioned. I was interested in finding out a little bit more about just how you've noticed the difference between working in both higher ed and K-12 education. Myself, I've only worked mostly in K-12. I did higher ed a little bit at the beginning of my teaching career, but it's been a long time. So what just both with the students, but also just kind of with, you know, the administrative tasks and kind of the expectations that are placed upon educators. What do you notice?
Mm-hmm. Well, I could talk about that for ages, probably. Dana, you might have to stop me. I've taught higher ed in a couple of different scenarios. So I taught at the, University of Northeastern Illinois University, let's be specific because there's so many Illinois universities, but Northeastern Illinois University in Chicago. And that was my first higher ed teaching experience. And I was, that university is unique in that it is a fully commuter school. It is also the most diverse university in Illinois and has the largest proportion of non-traditional students. So that's older students, returning students, students with non-traditional education backgrounds. At it. And while I was teaching there, I was really struck by the passion of the students to learn and their desire to engage and also some things that I'd never encountered before. So I encountered plagiarism there that I'd never encountered in other environments and had to learn how to deal with academic integrity. And that's something that that kind of thing, that passion where you're choosing, right? This is something that every single student at that school in my classes chose to go to that university. They wanted to be in that class. They wanted to succeed in the classes that I was teaching. You don't necessarily get that in K-12, right? Because it's required. It's mandatory attendance. Your kids, as an English teacher, your kids don't get to pick if they're in your class or not. So you don't have the same level of engagement. Now, that being said, I also taught at Lake Washington Technical College here in our area, in the Seattle area. And I had students that the students in my class there, classes there, they had to take the class as well. So it was a mandatory requirement for them in order to get into their degree programs. And they, again, then you kind of face that same level of maybe lower engagement, lower passion on behalf of the students. I think I also taught at a Berufsschule in Germany in the Hamburg area as a Fulbright. And that is it's a grade 10 through 13, but it's considered a technical college. So, and their education system is different in Germany. So students are tracked in grade five, and in grade five, they're placed in a tracking system. And then based on which track they're put in, they either complete school at grade 10, or they can go through grade 13 and be university prep. So this college that I was teaching at was considered a technical college for students who were looking to enter the trades. And then there was a portion of it that was for students who were looking to enter trades, but at the university level, if that makes any sense. So either to teach those trades, you still have to go to university to get your teaching certificates, or to actually become an engineer or a mechanic at the university level, or postgraduate level. So that type of schooling, I think, more akin to our K-12, even though it's technical college. As far as administration goes, I've definitely found that my administration is far more invested and engaged as a K-12 educator than as a higher ed educator. So in higher ed, you know, you have your course evaluations and you have your mandatory trainings and you're probably on some committees, but that's about it. There's not a lot of counseling you how to teach better. Or instructional, I guess that should be called instructional coaching. There's not a lot of instructional coaching at the higher ed level, which is ironic given that a lot of professors have never been teachers, even though they're content area specialists. They don't necessarily ever get taught pedagogy. So I still find that really ironic that there's so little instructional coaching in higher ed, and in K-12, there's there's a tremendous movement towards instructional coaching. And for the most part in our K-12 systems, we have instructional coaches for different things, right? We have our literacy instructional coaches and our numeracy instructional coaches and our technology instructional coaches and instructional coaches, and they're all working together collaboratively with the teachers, ideally, right? That doesn't happen in all systems, but ideally. And another huge difference is, of course, we have a strong focus in K-12 these days on mental health and on social emotional services for our students, and school counselors are invested in the K-12 organization, whereas in higher ed, of course, that's separate. It's completely separate. And you would, there's really no good system for referring a student for counseling, even if your campus has counselors on campus and students have access to them. They're not working with the professors like they would in a K-12 setting. I think that's an interesting difference to note in our current day and age.
Yeah, no, I think that's that resonates kind of like when I was in college, and you know, it was years ago now, but like, you know, as a undergrad, and how you, and this was abroad and in the state, same thing, like you have to like seek out help yourself, right? If you want counseling, you might have heard about like, we have these counseling services, or we have these, you know, our health center, and you heard about that when you first started orientation, but it's not something that's like every professor starts a class and says, these are the resources we have on campus, right? Mm-hmm. And also the fact that you're talking about the just the instructional coaches, right? I mean, I kind of think back to my undergrad as well, and how the professors I had, like for most of my classes, you know, did a pretty good pedagogy, but we had like a guest professor, I remember, for a week. And that person, like I majored in French, and you know, the person obviously was an expert in like French literature, but I remember their accent was so thick. Like they, you know, I was in Norway, and so they had such a thick Norwegian accent in French, and you know, and they kind of just lectured, right? And it was like, okay, we're just taking notes the whole time. But I just remembered how, like, you know, yes, the PhDs that they use at the university, they, you know, they know their niche, right, in that subject area, but they don't have the experience maybe of the practical, mm-hmm. right?
Yep.
As opposed to teaching like foreign language at the K-12 level, you are usually more involved in the professional organizations. Mm-hmm. Often you travel with your students on trips to the target country and those type of things. And I also thought it was interesting how you mentioned, yeah, that you taught in Germany as a Fulbright scholar. And how long ago was that?
That was 2005, 2006.
Okay. Yeah. So I haven't been a Fulbright scholar myself, but I taught back, you know, early 2000s in both Quebec, Canada, and then I was in Norway 2002 to 2003.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. I remember it was around that time, I think it was 07, 08, this high school I worked at here in Denver, we hosted a Fulbright Spanish teacher. Mm-hmm. So that was cool because we had, you know, the other Spanish teacher went to that lady's school and wherever, yeah. I don't remember which Spanish-speaking country that was, but we had that Spanish teacher then come in, you know, and learn kind of about the American system. So, mm-hmm. but yeah, you have such a full range of just diverse experience, and I like how you kind of mentioned those different areas of how, you know, it is different, and, you know, we do have those students in higher ed who most of the time are choosing to take that class, but I kind of mirror your experience in, like, you know, like I taught like English comp, right, for freshmen, and
yep.
they have to take that class.
Yep.
So, and I remember like back in 2004 at the university level, I also taught beginner French, which usually a foreign language is required mm-hmm. for certain majors. So a lot of the students had to be in that class because it was required for their major. But then I think the most involved student that I had in that class was a non-traditional, like, lady in her 40s. Yes. Right? Yep. Because she really wanted to take the class.
Yep.
Not the traditional student. So I think, you know, it kind of depends on who you're teaching and where you are. But yeah, definitely you do see a lot more of that support of the individual teacher and development of pedagogy at the K-12 level, at least what you're saying and I've experienced as well. So let's just talk a little bit about your faith and how your faith has served you in your work. You know, you're working right now in a faith-based school. How does that help you when you're able to talk with colleagues when you're having a bad day and you're struggling with different things?
Yeah, I feel like you just said it right there. I mean, that's, and I know, like, so I've worked in public education, in public ed, in both higher ed and K-12, as well as in now in faith-based education. So Northeastern Illinois is public ed. I worked in the Bellevue School District here as well, which is public ed. And I teach at Seattle Pacific University, which is a faith-based university. And I'm at Bear Creek School, which is a faith-based K-12 or pre-K or preschool through 12. So I kind of have been in both settings at all levels. And the main difference I've had, so I've had great community and great friends in both, in all places. The difference really is that when you have a common foundation that's not just based in your workplace, right? So yes, a common commitment to academic rigor is great. A common commitment to lifelong learning is great. But when you have that foundation of faith that you can fall back on with your colleagues if you need to, it makes a huge difference. And being able to come to my peers and not just talk about what is happening at school, but talk about like spiritually what's happening or what I'm struggling with and ask for prayer, it's incredibly uplifting and freeing to know that I can be vulnerable in those ways and know that people are with me and are willing to come alongside me and support me. And of course, it's still person by person. I'm not saying that everybody in a faith-based community is going to accept that level of vulnerability or be a safe space for you. They're not. Just like in any community, there's always going to be places where you are safe and places where you're not. But knowing that I can fall back on a common commitment to faith and to the values that are, I don't know if I want to use the word values, just the faith commitments that are espoused in that particular faith, they go a long way towards mutual understanding and being able to gather together. We have voluntary prayer times at our school. They're not mandatory for teachers, but if teachers want to participate, they can come and submit prayer requests or just be there to pray with their colleagues, and a way to support each other, both in the classroom and outside of the classroom. It's been an incredibly rich experience to be able to do that and to know that we are speaking the same, well, I don't want to say the same language, but it's like we're connecting on a slightly different level than a traditional colleague friendship.
Yeah, no, I think that's really interesting, and in how, you know, in a faith-based school, you're able to kind of be more open, I guess, with your faith, as opposed to in public ed, you know, there are people in that setting that probably share your faith, but that will come out in conversation once you get to know them, right? Mm-hmm. And talk about maybe your free time activities and stuff. But, you know, you won't have that like prayer time, right? In mm-hmm. K-12 public education, you're not able to, you know, talk and, you know, about any religious things with students. So, yeah. You know, the closest you get is that, you know, the high school or middle school club sometimes, you know, Fellowship of Christian Athletes or something. So,
yeah.
You know, it's interesting to see how, you know, that helps when, you know, you need that support. And that kind of segues into our next question about how does community support you in getting out of the trenches?
Yeah. Well, it's a little bit of a different answer, like pre-COVID versus now, to be honest, because, pre-COVID, I was really invested in, it's not just pre-COVID, but I'd say up until last year, I was really invested in a local dance community and had started dancing with this group 7 years ago, almost maybe, yeah, next year it'll be 8 years, I think. And it's a group of women, and that having that group of women to be with physically, but also there's a Facebook group. So currently it's just reverted to the Facebook community, but it's the most supportive group of women I've ever been around, ever. I mean, it is amazing. I would recommend this group to any woman who it doesn't want to deal with a lot of the difficulties that can happen in large groups of women. Let's just put it that way, because I know we have both genders listening to this podcast. but I've never been in a group of women that is as supportive and accepting and understanding and loving as this group of dancers. And so that being able to go and take classes with this group was a tremendous resource to me when I was teaching K-12 and then became a trainer and instructional coach, and just being able to go and have that release and that community, even if we didn't talk to each other during our classes. And in that particular way, I do, like, I know we say 10 minutes of meditating, or, and like the research, there's research out there about short periods of time being beneficial for our mental health and our physical health, as far as exercise and meditation and whatnot go. But our dance classes were actually an hour and 45 minutes long, every single one of them. And that hour and 45 minutes almost became a sacred space for anyone who was participating, because you had to have your phone turned off. You couldn't, you know, you couldn't do anything else. You were not permitted to, and you had to engage fully. And going beyond that, you know, 10 or 15 minutes of meditating or exercise or HIIT training or whatever it is that you do. I do all those other things too, but having that longer period of time designated really meant you sunk into yourself. And that was another thing, is that the dance classes were very much focused interior. So there was technical aspects to it, but was a lot more about listening to your body and how your body is feeling the movement and how it needs to interpret whatever technique or movement is being taught in that session. And so you become much more self-focused than you're ever permitted to be in our modern culture. Mm-hmm. And being able to do that for a set period of time, either weekly or biweekly, however often you went to classes, was an amazingly revitalizing experience. Now that has shifted, because I can't do in-person classes now. And while the studio has opened up to a very limited degree and they are doing online classes, I don't have a space to do online classes, and I'm not quite ready to be in a enclosed, sweaty workout environment with my peers yet at this point. So I'm only engaged with that community on Facebook right now. And it's, I feel the loss. Mm-hmm. And, when you've had an outlet like that for so long, it's shifted that now I find my community in other places, but it's not as deep and as rich as that community, even though we're still in contact, virtually.
Mm-hmm. Do you have other communities that you, like, you can mention where the community is important for you? We talked a little bit in the pre-chat about the strong friendships, Okinawa, and those type of things.
Yeah, I just was mentioning the research that's been done on, like, the longest lived communities in the world. And there's those communities on the island of Okinawa that are the longest lives. And a lot of that research points to those strong relationships that are built and intentionally maintained. Not, yeah. I kind of feel like Americans, we like accidentally maintain relationships. Yeah. At least, like, I have a he just turned 9 this summer. I have a 9-year-old, and I kind of feel like since I became a parent, a lot of my relationships are accidental instead of intentional, just because of timing and work. You know, I'm a working parent, all of that, that it becomes a lot more accidental. But I'll tell you, my intentional relationships, they're actually, my intentional community is more individual nowadays than it is group centered. So I do have a few close friends who I try to reach out to and be in communication with. And I see, and my family has become more of an intentional community to me than it was before. I mean, my extended family, which is also actually quite small compared to some people I know who have lots of cousins and aunts and uncles and everything. And I don't really have all of that, but we are being more intentional about our communication with each other nowadays. My church community is also a place that I turn, but we're not worshiping in person right now. It's all still virtual. We're a large church, and we've just decided as a congregation, the leadership has decided it's not time to be back in a building together, given the virus situation. So we still worship virtually on Sundays. And so even that has shifted, and it's very different, even though we know that we can go to them for prayer or for conversation. It's not the same as seeing everybody or, you know, seeing people on a weekly basis. So I would say that for me, what used to be maybe more of a group-oriented community is now individuals who are my community.
Yeah, I kind of shared your thoughts a little bit with, you know, you talked about dance, and I've been involved in a choir for, see, it's about 9 years in the town, the area I live in. And I was out of choir for a long time because the other choirs in the Denver area were like 45 minutes away. And I, didn't want to, you know, take a long drive after work in the evening. But this choir, the Castle Rock Chorale, when they started in 2011, it was right where I lived. And then we had a shift with the founder ended up leaving. And so we didn't have, after I think it was November of 18, it took a little while before we had a new director who then started September of 19. And as you can imagine,
yeah,
you know, we had a Christmas, you know, little thing in downtown when they have their lighting of the star. But, you know, after that, I mean, we had a couple of rehearsals in January and February, and then that just fell apart. And then, you know, they were emailing over the summer about, let's see if we can get things together and maybe find a different rehearsal space. But, you know, I was fine. You know, I said, can we maybe rehearse outdoors? Mm-hmm. But, you know, given there were older people in the choir, you know, and so, you know, they postponed getting back together until January, and hopefully things will look better. But, you know, I do miss that community of, and then being able to sing, and the fact that we did have almost a year when we had a director being replaced. And, you know, now it's pretty much a year again. And, I feel sad about, you know, there's not really, they do have virtual choirs that you can submit songs to, and you're part of a video with 1,000 singers or
right.
Some of the choir members have been in videos with like 8,000 singers, I've heard it.
Wow. They're
sending those emails to the people in the choir. If you want to be in this, you know, this massive like production, right? Mm-hmm. I'm like, well, they're not going to see me on the video if there's 8,000 singers.
Yeah.
So, you know, that's one thing I miss. And, you know, I like how you talked about like the dance. You know, it is hard when you're in a space that you can't do the rehearsals, but you've kind of shifted that over to other things. And, you know, as a parent as well, you know, a lot of your relationships, like you said, are accidental. And I think a lot of the relationships that I've had since being in education are people that I've met at work, right? Mm-hmm. That I've like, when I've left that position, I've still remained in contact with them. Right. And so it's just kind of interesting how like you see people's lives evolve, whether or not they're maybe in the same parenting area. I've had several single friends who never had kids, but, mm-hmm. you know, also those educators that have maybe since retired or, you know, just left education and but you still have contact with them, even if you worked with them 10 years ago or something and they've gone to different positions as well. So, but yeah, kind of, yeah, it's interesting. Yeah, like you mentioned, Okinawa and the relationships are intentionally maintained, right? And I think in the U.S., because I've lived abroad, how, you know, a lot of the relationships in the U.S. are more superficial, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. Like, it's kind of like those kind of Facebook relationships, like you said. You know, the bigger a Facebook group that you're in with women, right, the more there's going to be complaining about stuff, right? Mm-hmm. And, you know, the smaller the group you're in, the more you're able to maybe connect with those people. But mm-hmm. yeah, there's definitely that hole with, you know, the church I go to, they're doing outdoor services, but they're not doing the small, mm-hmm. like groups, right? They haven't really, or some people, maybe they've put out invites, but people aren't going. So, you know, there's kind of a lack of, you know, having that community as well. But you know, I think it's been really great to discuss everything just about your love of nature, your experience in K-12 and higher ed, and your just experience about, you know, working in different settings and in, you know, faith-based and public ed. Out of everything we discussed today, what's one thing you'd really like listeners to remember?
I think that notion of intentional community. Mm-hmm. And okay, two things.
Sure.
Two things. intentional community and making space for being outside. Mm-hmm. And I know that I'm very privileged that where I live there is lots of green space, and that not everybody has access to that. And in our urban environment here in Seattle, we're actually building a bunch of new trails and systems to connect the green space with spaces that have not traditionally had green space access, and, you know, land that was just kind of left wild and overgrown, and turning it into proper trails and space for people to take advantage of who have lived in areas where they don't have that. And I think working with your communities to help find that space for people to recreate outdoors in the green is something that I'd want people to think about, because it's such a valuable part of having a revitalize and rejuvenation in your world, and making sure that everybody has access to that is really important.
Yeah, I agree with you. I like how, you know, towns build extra trails, right? Whether they're dirt or paved trails, and, you know, expand their trail network. And, you know, you can always go out and explore those trails. And, you know, that's very important for the parks and recs of the different cities to put money into. Where can people find you online?
I think the best place is probably Twitter. I'm at Suz Teaches, S-U-Z Teaches. And yeah, that's where I hang out. I like to respond to people. I'll post things occasionally, and I do, it's a professional, what do you even call it? it's a professional account, but I do still put things that I'm interested in and that I care about on there. So I'm not just retweeting brand content, even though I do some of that too, because I get very excited about some of the brand content.
Well, I'll put that in the show notes. And I thank you so much for being on the Out of the Trenches podcast today. It was really great getting to talk to you.
Thank you for having me. I enjoy getting to talk and hearing your perspective on things. I think we actually have a lot in common there. So that was fun.
Okay, thanks.